Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
You're listening to Disability Pride, 3CR's all-day broadcast on International Day of People with a Disability. Hi, I'm Helen Gwilliam. For the next half hour of this special Disability Day broadcast, we're bringing you a speaker from the Union Activism and History Conference, held at the Victorian Trades Hall in Melbourne in October this year. Adam Bottomley is a delegate with the Australian Services Union and a passionate advocate for workers and for the rights of people with disability. In his wide-ranging discussion, Adam analyses the oppression of people with disability from a historical and political perspective, and the role of capital and neoliberalism in that oppression. This is Adam Bottomley.
People with disabilities are a significantly oppressed group in society. That is, they are structurally and systematically disadvantaged. This disadvantage, the impoverishment, the disempowerment, the exclusion, it's not natural. It doesn't have to exist. And the oppression of people with disabilities is tied to the economic and social priorities of the system of capitalism. And so today, I'm going to talk about the social model of disability. I'm going to look at some of the origins of disability oppression. I'll tell some of the history of the disability rights movement and link all of that back to the NDIS today. So first, what is disability? Defining disability is actually pretty central to the debates around, or if you like, the politics of disability in the disability sector. The definition is massively contested amongst people with disabilities, let alone amongst everyone else. But let's start with what is actually a significantly limited definition, which is used in Australia's Disability Discrimination Act. So it describes the total or partial loss of the person's bodily or mental functions. And this loss of functioning can include conditions present from birth or which occur through a person's life. It can be the result of injury. It can be caused by preventable infections, including things like tuberculosis or malaria, illness resulting from chronic diseases, heart disease, diabetes or arthritis, mental illness, intellectual disability, learning disabilities, and so on. So this definition that disability is located within the body and as a purely medical condition was the standard for a very long time in much of the developed world, and apparently Australia still is. But in the 1970s, in the context of the radicalisation that was happening around the world, a group of people in England made a critical breakthrough separating the impairment from disability. And so this group called themselves the Union of the Physically Impaired Against Segregation. They were actually a group of socialists, all of who had disabilities themselves, and they declared that unlike impairment, disability was not biologically determined, that it was actually a social creation and could therefore be challenged and eliminated. So they wrote in their statement of principles, "In our view, it is society that disables physically impaired people. Disability is something imposed on top of our impairments by the way that we are unnecessarily isolated and excluded from full participation in society." And they describe disability as the disadvantage or restriction of activity caused by a contemporary social organisation which takes little or no account of people who have physical impairments and thus excludes them from the mainstream of social activities. So while disability is seen in purely medical terms, then the person with the disability is the victim, and either a doctor of some kind is the expert who can save them, or there is no saving them, and the person will either just live a reduced life of exclusion, or they will be taken care of by the goodwill charity of others. Whereas the social model of disability provides a framework for critiquing the way that the world around us excludes and disadvantages people. It emphasises the citizenship of people with disabilities and asserts that they have rights which should and can be met. And so this breakthrough was a launching pad for a wave of protest in the 1970s onwards. And I'll say more about that later. So apart from sketching out the social model of disability, I wanted to share some figures which I think will clarify the scale of the oppression faced by people with disabilities and also how many of us do experience disability or will in our lives. So the World Health Organization reports that more than 1 billion people globally are currently disabled, and almost 80% of us all will experience temporary or permanent disability in our lives. Roughly 20% of Australians have a disability, and that figure more than doubles in Indigenous communities. The chances of having a disability massively increase as we age, indicating that most forms of it involve illness, injury, or mental illness developed later in life. The experience of disability varies enormously depending on the country that a person lives in, their class, their ethnicity, their gender and so on. But this in no way means that living in Australia with a disability puts you on easy street. Of the people in Australia with a disability, 45% live at or below the poverty line. In a variety of ways, disability contributes to poverty and poverty contributes to disability. People with disability in Australia are 2.7 times more likely to live in poverty than non-disabled people. When you rank the countries of the OECD by this measure, Australia comes in 27th out of 27 countries. So the Australian ruling class performs the best at impoverishing people with disabilities. The labour participation rate in Australia for people with a disability in February was 25%, the participation rate. So that means 75% of people with disabilities are excluded from employment, which usually means depending on family support or depending on benefits for survival. Studies have indicated that nearly 70% of people receiving Centrelink pensions live below the poverty line. I don't understand how the other 30% do not live below the poverty line. Having a disability nearly halves your chances of finishing Year 12. Roughly 30% of expelled students in Victoria have some form of disability or mental illness. During 2015, at least 65,000 Australians spent time in prisons, and half of them had disabilities, usually cognitive impairments or mental illness. Disability discrimination is the most widely reported type of discrimination in Australia, and studies indicate that in some states, 90% of women with intellectual disabilities have been sexually abused. And then there's the stigma. And it's both too easy and too hard to describe, to quantify stigma. One indication, I think, is that Australian people with a disability have, on average, worse mental health than people who have experienced the death of a spouse in the last 12 months. That's the impact, yeah. Psychological impact. I can go on more and more with these stats. It does get pretty depressing. We can just say that for many people living with a disability, the combination of poverty and exclusion from society and stigma is very, very bad. And keep in mind that all of the statistics that I've just given are not about impairments. They're about the relationship to society. They're about disability. So they're about the poverty, exclusion and stigma, all of which are socially created by underfunding, lack of decent housing, education, jobs, health services, community supports and so on, all things that are possible. And so disability oppression is something that can and unconditionally should be fought. Now, it sounds strange, but disabled people were invented. So the label, the categorisation, the impoverishment, the exclusion and stigma, these were all historical phenomena which emerged at a certain time in the development of human societies. Archaeologists and historians have found clear evidence of people living with serious impairment going back over 1.5 million years, and all signs are that those people were well cared for and lived lives equal in length and quality to those without impairment in the same communities. And there's countless examples of this. Again, it's really fascinating history, but just one that I like. So the roughly 4,000-year-old remains of a male were found in Vietnam a couple of decades ago. And it was, it was identified that when he was a teenager, he had become paralysed from the waist down and most likely did not have movement of his arms. So that he developed that injury or illness in his teen years, and he lived until he was in his 30s. And so the archaeologists involved report that his survival reflects high-quality, continuous and time-consuming care within a technologically unsophisticated prehistoric society. So these type of small, nomadic, hunter-gatherer societies form the majority of human existence as a species, about 90%. And they were defined by, and their survival depended on, egalitarian sharing and participation where everyone had a role to play in the community. So there's no evidence that people with impairments were excluded or marginalised in those pre-class societies. We want rights, not charity.
We want rights, not charity. Hi, you're listening to 3CR. 8:55 a.m. and streaming live on 3cr.org.au on International Day of People with Disability. We're listening to Adam Bottomley, speaking at the Union Activism and History Conference in Melbourne in October 2017 about the history of disability rights, power and capitalism.
Okay, so we'll zoom ahead quite a bit to the early days of capitalism and the Industrial Revolution in England and France. In feudal Europe, if we sort of look at maybe the 1600s to 1800s, most of society was involved in agricultural production, so either as landowners or as the people doing the agricultural work themselves. to, you know, opposed classes. Now, farming in that period was mostly small scale. The productive unit was generally the family or the extended family. Literacy wasn't really a thing. Mobility wasn't that important, with largely subsistence living. So most people actually had or could produce what they needed within close range. So it was quite easy for people with physical or mental impairments to be integrated into the work that needed to be done on the land that they were on. In this period, there was no broad category of disabled. There was impairment, of course, but most of these didn't exclude people from participating in normal daily life. Some people with impairments were housed in big monasteries and cared for by the church in Western Europe, but these are only a tiny minority, only the people with the most serious impairments. And so two big changes happened to this picture. Through the 16th century, the Reformation happens, the power and functioning of the Catholic monasteries is reduced, and so the system of care for people with the most serious disabilities is removed from society. But the most significant change was in how most of the production in society was organised. So first, technological developments meant that production could happen faster and more efficiently in centralised workplaces. For instance, basic machinery like spinning machines for cotton, increased transportation methods, new systems of fast-paced, repetitive tasks in concentrated workshops all meant that the factory system rose very, very quickly. And to support this change in how production is organised, millions of agricultural workers or peasants were forcibly kicked off the land, and without the ability to survive on the land that they used to live on, they're forced into working for a boss in these new things called factories, but also in the mines, in the mills, docks and shipping and so on. And so all of these workplaces get bigger and bigger, which means the build-up of much bigger cities and the reality of wage labour, as we know it today, becomes more and more dominant. So working in these new big workplaces generally requires that workers can travel there from where they live. They can work the precise hours that the boss requires, and of course, the bosses are not interested in employing workers who might be slower at the work or who might need extra supports. And so people with impairments are forced off the land, they generally can't find employment, the monasteries are shutting down, and their families as well are required to go to work every day for incredibly long hours and are not able to provide any care. So the state, or the government institutions, step in and take key responsibility for the care of people with impairments. But one, they want to pay as little as possible to support people who can't work. And two, they want to make sure that they don't pay to support people who can work but don't want to. And so they create these places called poorhouses, which are basically institutions where life's crap and abusive, but you don't have to work. And they create these other places called workhouses where life's even crapper, but where you do have to work. Oh, and also, in the workhouses, you can be whipped and branded, like with hot things, yeah. There are loads of people who understandably don't want to work, but how does the state decide who gets into the poorhouse and who gets into the workhouse? Well, they begin to refer in the poor laws, which in England was sort of the basic laws, you know, what we'd call the early days of some semblance of a welfare state. They begin to refer in the poor laws, which govern these things, to either the able-bodied in society or the impotent. And the impotent includes lunatics, which meant mentally ill, idiots, which included, you know, which meant intellectual impairments, the blind, the lame, which meant injured or physical impairments, and so on and so on. And so we've got here the historic creation of the category that would become known as the disabled, the creation of the themes of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, and the clear purpose of this category, these categories, is to assess the capacity of people to work productively for a capitalist in this new system of production where bosses exploit workers for profits in direct competition with other bosses. So that's capitalism. Now, with the expansion of capitalism over the last few centuries, at times the ruling class have only locked up people with disabilities in institutions, and at other times they have basically waged a war on them. So we saw through the 18th and 19th centuries basically prisons of abuse with, you know, the normalisation of institutionalisation. The eugenics movement from the 1880s became the scientific justification for the systematic forced sterilisation of people with intellectual disabilities and mental illness. So over the course of the 20th century, 15 million people globally suffered forced sterilisation. 400,000 in Germany during the 1930s and 65,000 in the US, just to name two. Possibly the apex of brutality, capitalism and disability taken to its extreme occurred in Germany with the systematic murder of 275,000 people with disabilities. By any measure, the scale of oppression of people with disabilities over the centuries reached epic proportions. So again, we live in a social and economic system based on the competition for profits, where the minority of people own and control most of the wealth and production. Politicians do their bidding. The heads of the various social institutions run their system in their interests, and these groups make up a ruling class. And the only value that the rest of us hold for them is if we can work efficiently to produce their wealth and run their cities, help them fill their pockets, and economically compete with their business rivals. Those of us who can't help the capitalists in that grotesque project are left to survive as best as we can, in poverty, stigmatised and excluded, and in the worst cases, literally left to die. But at times throughout history, this oppression and this mistreatment has been challenged, it's been pushed back, and it's been stopped by resistance from below, by fierce, collective, disruptive, beautiful resistance, which has forced ruling classes to concede a better life for people with disabilities.
We want rights, not charity. We want rights, not charity. Rights, not charity. Cause charity keeps you where you think I should be.
You're listening to 3CR's all-day broadcast celebrating International Day of People with Disability. We're listening to Adam Bottomley from the Australian Services Union, talking about the history and achievements of the disability rights movement and the need to ensure the National Disability Insurance Scheme doesn't entrench a neoliberal model that privatises disability services under the guise of choice and further entrenches exclusion and poverty for many people with disability.
The pioneers of the disability rights campaigns go back a long way, at least to the 1920s and the 1930s in Europe and the US in particular. And in the movements, there were always a left and a right. There were always people who accepted the crumbs and sought to avoid conflict with those in power. And there were people who understood that power concedes nothing without a demand. Those who understood that collective action in disrupting the smooth running of things can force the system to recognise you and your needs. People who understood that solidarity with other oppressed and exploited groups gives you power. And it's these people, these fighters, troublemakers and organisers who have actually changed the world that we live in today. And there have actually been large and successful disability rights movements all over the world. In India, Mexico, South Africa, Brazil, Sweden, Zimbabwe, Hong Kong, Indonesia and so on. I'm just going to focus on some stories from the UK and the US and Australia, partly because they're the stories that you can find easily and partly because they were some of the most leading movements around the world. So just to skim through some of the accounts, there were marches of blind people and injured returned soldiers in the UK following the First World War, mostly demanding access to decent jobs and to stop on-the-job discrimination. Similarly, in the US, employers could openly say in the 1930s, they could put up signs and ads saying only able-bodied people may apply. So in 1935, a group of returned soldiers with disabilities who had been around the Communist Party in the US went to the office of the government works department in New York and occupied it for 9 days. And they couldn't have done that without the support of hundreds of people outside, defending them from the police, bringing supplies and publicising what was going on. The media attacked them as communist cripples, but it's sort of true. But rude. But they won 1,500 jobs for people with disabilities, and they desegregated workplaces. 9 day occupation. Amazing. In the US, actually, one of the first radical critics of the treatment of people with disabilities was Helen Keller, who was famously born deaf and blind but learned how to communicate. And then, less famously, she became a revolutionary socialist, actually, and an agitator against the war, both on the side of striking workers and for disability rights. The radical movement for disability rights suffered through the period of McCarthyism, as all movements did, but in the 60s and 70s it was revived by the general upturn in the civil rights and the student and the labour struggles. Key demands in this period were often around anti-discrimination laws and changes to the way that public spaces were built, including things like ramps, accessible public transport, curb cuts. And fighting to change public space really lends itself to just showing up somewhere in big numbers and just disrupting shit until you get arrested. And one activist organisation that played a really large role and is still active today is ADAPT from the US. In the US, disabled students at the University of California formed the Independent Living Centre, which was a mix of political organising space and a support network, further developing the social model theories that are developed in the UK. There are also campaigns to desegregate education, for access to enabling equipment, and against the stigmatising of mental illness and disability. People with disabilities often use direct action, occupations and the blocking of roads to disrupt the smooth running of things. They would chain themselves to the axles of public transport, of buses and so on, and they would call for the right to boldly go where everyone else has gone before. In the 1980s, in what I think was a world first, a group of people in Australia, people with mental health issues, stormed a psychiatric treatment centre. They tore out an electroshock therapy unit and they danced around the outside of the centre in front of the media, like a good old-fashioned, you know, rampaging mob. In 1981, a group of activists, including, you know, a heroic figure called Leslie Hall, disrupted the live broadcast of the Miss Australia beauty pageant finals, which, protesting both the sexist nature of the event, but also the fact that the Spastic Society, a disabled charity, disability charity, would use the sort of pretty faces of these people, these women, to fundraise for the sort of broken people with disabilities. And Hall had, you know, a track record of supporting the struggles of unionised workers and other gay rights, so they got a lot of support. Australia had more than its fair share of protests around these demands, and the legacy of those victories literally shaped the world that we live in, and they allowed people with disabilities to move, you know, much further into the mainstream. So how do we assess the NDIS then against the demands of the disability rights movement historically? Two stories are coming out of people's experiences of the rollout of the NDIS. One is a wave of criticisms that you can read about pretty much daily when you open the newspapers. Most of these, I think, are either about the really shoddy rollout process of the NDIS, many of which are having devastating effects on people's lives. To me, it seems like a lot of these problems could probably be fixed with, you know, a better funded and staffed system, and if they had some, you know, element of direct control from people with disabilities, a lot of these problems could probably be fixed. All signs, though, at the moment are that neither of those things are about to happen. The polite requests of disability advocacy groups for years now have actually been totally ignored. The second story coming out about the NDIS rollout is the experience of people who have funding and therefore access to supports that they previously did not have. And this needs to be recognised as making, you know, significant improvements to the lives of some thousands of people with disabilities, their families and their carers. The problems that were widespread in the disability sector previously, so the chronic underfunding, massive waiting lists, very minimal control, the support received, they can all, you know, they were the sort of hallmarks of the system. And so I think the NDIS, the funding that's attached to it, the sort of the semblance of choice over where you can purchase your support, plus the sort of the fairly significant fanfare and, you know, good branding job that the NDIS received, all of this can add up to a pretty appealing package and even fit in with what seem like the demands of the disability rights movement. So, you know, proper funding and control, as the saying used to go, nothing about us without us. The most serious problem with the model, though, in the long run, is that it will lock in a user pay system for disability and for the ongoing privatisation of care. So pre-NDIS, many disability services operated on a more or less universal health model, where they could decide who they would support, and they could provide that support based on block funding that usually lasted for years. The new model changes all of that, I think, for the worse. The NDIA, the government agency running the scheme, is the only gatekeeper to all services. So if you're deemed not to qualify for support, that's it. They decide who is the, you know, deserving disabled and who are the undeserving disabled. But if you miss out, the government can just say to you, don't worry, you can still get the support, you've just got to pay for it. You've just got to go and purchase it yourself. That's for people who miss out altogether. But imagine how easy it is for them in a year or two, or whenever they choose to say to the people who have qualified for a plan, actually, we can't give you $60,000 this year. You'll have to make do with $40,000, or you'll have to make do with $20,000. But don't worry, you can still get the support. You just go and pay for it yourself. So I think the NDIS will give people with disabilities choice and control over the products that they buy. You know, name another area of life where being able to control the products that you buy actually equals liberation. So I think all of this opens up the door to a two-tiered disability sector where the rich will be able to afford the best care, the best services and equipment, and the poor will be lucky to get low-quality supports or nothing at all. For a while, the universal support for the NDIS, I think, scared off a range of people from openly attacking or opposing the NDIS model. not us. We were happy to make criticisms. But the wave of criticism coming from service users now, I think, really lays the basis for a campaign that unites and mobilises both people with disabilities and disability workers.
But we want rights, not charity. We want rights, not charity. Rights, not charity. Because charity keeps me where you think I should be.
You've been listening to Adam Bottomley, ASU delegate at the Union Activism and History Conference, held at the Victorian Trades Hall in Melbourne in October this year. Many thanks to Adam and to 3CR programmer Annie McLaughlin for recording this piece. The song you heard during this programme was Rights Not Charity by the Karen Shedder Band from the UK. Stay listening to Disability Pride, 3CR's all-day broadcast for International Day of People with Disability, with you until 7pm. Next is Invisible Disability with Mario and Maurice from a new 3CR show, Chronically Chilled, providing a platform to those living with chronic and invisible illness.
Again, there'll be blind boys in the gutter,
young mothers becoming whores, cause the government has screwed us. They don't want us anymore. It's Black Thursday and the mission bell rings. Bring out your dying to do one last thing. Prove to us you're dead. It's the only way to gain some respect, cause right now is Judgment Day.
Of us who care, the pain in our hearts stole into the air, the hope in our hearts turned into despair, and nothing could prepare us for the pain in plain sight. It was just the beginning of the fight.